You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 64 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Tilly.
And I'm Ash.
And this is the second part of our discussion with Caroline Nicolai, chatting all about archaeoconstruction, or retrofit, as I learned last episode, which is a completely new term to me. So let's just remind ourselves of where we were before we were rudely interrupted by some dragons landing on the roof.
Smaug.
Yeah, Smaug. I mean, you know, it was...
Say his name.
Yeah. A smile. It was smile.
We don't have a chimney now. Thanks.
Look, I didn't really... it was a tough moment for me. Anyway, we've been commissioned by the Anduin Fallowhide Fellowship of Museums and Antiquity to help them with building a replica of one of their fallowhide, which, as you will know, is the kind of hunter-gatherer society of some of the earlier hobbit species, seasonal settlements, which was recently found during their excavations of the Great Shelf in the Vales of Anduin. They want it to be as accurate to the excavated seasonal structure as possible. So to help us in this reconstruction, we have enlisted the assistance of the wonderful Caroline, who is very experienced in all sorts of cool traditional technological things, as we heard about last episode. So we spoke a little bit already last episode about some examples from archaeology that we, the three of us, have worked with or have sort of had experience with. And you already were talking a lot of, Caroline, about sort of different places in the UK and how there's different kinds of houses that you can build and everything. So, I mean, how would you even approach this? Like, how would we approach doing a reconstruction of a fallowhide seasonal settlement? What would we need to know?
Oh, first you ask Ash to have a look at the dig report. So if you have any kind of archaeology, that would be really the starting point. If you have nothing, that's gonna be difficult.
Do we have a site report, Ash?
Yes, luckily we do have a site
report. Thank goodness. Oh, isn't that convenient? Yeah. Excellent. Good, nice.
To me, it was very like Mesolithic. I don't know.
That's what
it seemed like. Kind of seasonal, moving around a bit, kind of maybe... folding down houses.
Folding down houses.
That's right.
So IKEA houses in my backpack.
So temporary settlements, or we don't see many traces, and they might have built something and they just use it part of the year and then come back to it. Kind of things like that. So ideally, you want to look at the archaeology, look at what the natural environment in this area at the time looked like. Is it a lot of forest? So in that case, yep, they are forest people. A lot of woods and woodland resources available. Are there any stones, any clay, any chalk, any specifics, really, anything? Even the plants will tell you that. So if you are in an agricultural society, that's my reset noises. If you have agriculture around, you can thatch with straw, any kind of cereal straw, any kind of grasses, things like that. So what we see quite often is people think thatch is only reed, water reed. No, it's not the case, and it has never been the case. Usually you thatch with what you have, and quite often, as soon as you hit agriculture, you have straw quite a lot. Reed, you have reed if you live near water replaces. So it's not always the case. You can use bracken, you can use heather, there might be slabs of thin turf as well underneath a thatch rather than on top. You can have a whole turf roof if you want to, if you have nothing else, or if it's better for what you're building. So we're very, not limited, but we're very single-minded usually in archaeology, and we only consider the materials that we have seen before, that we have heard about, and we don't remember to look at traditional building techniques in the local area or the grander area.
And because, so you've worked on a couple of, so we, for example, Ash already mentioned that you worked at the Cranog Centre.
A little bit, just for thatching a few roofs, yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. So for example, with that one, so how did you go about sort of in that particular case study with deciding what materials to use, etc.? Was it just, this is what they gave me?
Yeah, pretty much.
I went on the roof
and
did
exactly
it.
That. So that's not a great example, because I've been hired to thatch with the reed that they have, that they had on the house that they had built, with a very short space of time. So I was an emergency thatcher person.
That's so fun.
Emergency thatcher.
That's like the, what was the one from last episode? The mud?
Oh, the mud mason.
Mud Mason and Emergency Thatcher.
These are
all new jobs to aspire to.
But to give a very similar example, we're working on a project for the moment with my tutor in the south of England to produce plans and look at all of this for the site to make a new Iron Age roundhouse that they want to be representative of what the local archaeology is compared to making the same reed thatch and waterland daub roundhouse that pretty much everybody does in the UK, which is fine, but it doesn't apply to their particular case because they have a lot of chalk, they have a lot of big timbers, but in thatching materials, they don't have bracken or gorse or even broom. They would have had fields at the time, which means we don't really want to use reed. So we need to find the right kind of straw, which is rare nowadays, long straw. Mm. And we need to find thatching techniques that match Iron Age tools, Iron Age archaeology, and so on and so forth. So we're straying from what we usually see to make the archaeology match local traditions, materials, and what we know about the period.
Okay,
so that kind of fits for us, because where the Fallowhides live, they can speak to the Stours, which are the fishing people of the hobbits. So as we talked about, Tilly quite enthusiastically talked about. So yeah, could get potentially reeds from them. They've also got the Harfoots as well, which live in holes and burrows and things like that. And they also move. But they're in the Great Shelf, which is quite close to the elves.
Mm.
And they also live in very much woodland areas, and they move as they're kind of hunting, you know, different beasts and things like that. So there's a lot of different stuff that we could pull from the environment, and also connections, right? That would work.
Yeah, absolutely. So in that case, because they live in woodlands and they either make houses, well, say dwellings for a short period of time, or things to come back to periodically, they must be either very quick to put up, so you have all the timber and the tools you need. You can just pick whatever you prefer in the forest. Mm. Make a simple structure. You might not even bother with walls. So we see quite often what are called usually bender huts. So you have hazel and willow thin branches. So even children can go cut them and bring them back to your camp. Mm. And you almost make a woven basket upside down. That's it. You weave yourself a house. So you can tie it or you can weave it. And it just holds like that.
Someone specialized in this kind of construction is listening in going, oh, they've found my secret. I'm basically just a basket weaver.
I'm an upside down basket weaver. That's another one.
We have to make a list.
A list of what?
And then you could, if you have the time, you can gather some resources. So say earth and clay and things like that. Or you could use turf, or you could thatch it entirely. And when I say thatch it, instead of taking the time to either gather reed a bit further afield or chat with the riverside populations, you could get whatever you find. So instead of having a very neat, even thatch, you want something practical and done right now. So you can have a bit of broom, bracken, maybe some reed that you found, but there's only one pond, so you don't have enough for an entire roof. It doesn't matter. You can mix and match, because as long as it works. So we see that in repairs of traditional roofs as well. If it's not the season, you can't go and cut reed or bracken because it's not there, or it's too late, or it's too early. So you take what you have in store or what is available at the time, and you do that little patch and that little repair because you have a leak in the roof right now. So you have to imagine it a bit more mix and match.
I suppose as well, if you're seasonal and you're moving around, that will change over time. You know, it depends on what season you're, where you are, what environment you're in.
Very much. So maybe you could imagine some styles of summer dwellings and a completely different style in another location for winter ones. And maybe you'll stay longer, but you need more heat, so you need thicker walls or more thatch on top. And for the summer ones, it can be very light, and you might use, well, hides, for example, if you hunt quite a lot.
Do we see any of these types of houses in archaeological record anywhere? Can you think of any off the top of your head that we're thinking of with the fallow hides? These kind of seasonal, transitional houses that you can, you know, weave into a basket and off you go.
Well, the thing is, you mentioned Mesolithic, and it's I didn't study enough Mesolithic archaeology to be able to answer that completely. Sometimes you wouldn't see any traces in the archaeology at all. If you built in turf, you could make very thick, very cozy walls, for example, of houses, and they are load-bearing. So you would have earth walls, and then on top, maybe thatch and a structure made of wood. And if it collapses, there are no post holes, nothing at all you can find. Unless you have very specific, detailed archaeology, like in the Netherlands, where they can study layers and layers of turf buildings. It drives me nuts. It's so fine. Anyway, so when you find stake holes, oh, that's a weird word, instead of posts, so say sticks in the ground that have left a mark instead of massive tree trunks, we usually interpret that as a fence or wattle for dough, daub or something else. That's very quick and easy to make. So if I was to make really longer stay, say a winter temporary dwelling, I would do that. I would cut anything pretty small so children and elderly can help you as well.
Oh God, sorry, I thought you said... I thought you meant I would cut something pretty small, so children. So Caroline.
I'd probably eat my child.
The elderly.
You know you're saying this out loud, right?
Well, you know, in hunter-gatherer societies,
I gotta use those offices.
I thought it was a silence. I shall rephrase that.
I don't know. I'm talking to the elderly.
So they can give you a hand.
Yeah, okay, right.
Society, loving, caring. Yeah, they did not murder their children.
No, no.
Not for building houses.
Not that we know
no.
of. Yeah, exactly. No.
Yeah, so lighter materials make for lighter work, and then you have more people that can help you build. And it doesn't require woodworking techniques to make joints or planks or things like that. So I've recommended for, well, anybody, anything and everything really that's pretty quick to make, as long as you live in a woodland area. Otherwise, it's gonna be difficult. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I think that sounds very promising. Oh, wait, hang on. Oh, Tilly, do I see another tiny home being constructed in that cupboard again? Have you been shrinking people?
Yeah, but they wanted to stay. How could I tell them no? Hang on, I'll go talk to them.
Welcome back. Tilly, you need to stop leaving Lambus bread out for the guests. It only encourages permanent occupation. People have their own lives to live.
Well, you know what? I disagree with you, Ash, because are we not meant to feed our guests? Honestly, you're a terrible host. Anyway, talking about hosting and guests, let's get back to our particular guest, because we talked a little bit about what you're doing now and your experience with construction, but I suddenly realized we haven't actually asked how you got into this field in the first place. So last episode, when we were talking to you in episode, what was it, 49 and 50, we were talking about recipes and food archaeology and experimental archaeology. So how on earth did you start in construction? What happened there?
It's such a good, yeah, that's my life.
I'm trying to see the segue. I can't quite get it. Like, I'm cooking this meal. I need a kitchen to cook it on. Oh, I need to build a house to build the kitchen to cook it on. Oh, there we go.
I need to build a house.
Well, you know,
oh my God, I'm not in a house.
It's like the house that Jack built, you know. This is the house that Jack built. This is the person that lives in the house that Jack built. This is the person that drives the car that lives in the house that Jack built. Anyway, sorry.
Well, I think I started mainly because I worked at the Ancient Technology Centre down in the south of England. And apart from looking after the replica buildings, well, the reconstructed buildings on site, sometimes some schools or nature reserved asked us to make a little Iron Age, Iron Age van house for them. So woven wattle, very light structures, a little bit of thatch, reed thatch on the top, etc., etc. That's not based on any particular archaeology. It was mainly for children to have a place to go, relax, listen to stories, and have a bit of a go at natural materials. So, yeah, mainly my thatching experience, my development into, am I a thatcher? Well, I guess I thatch.
No, I thatch roofs.
I can thatch roofs, but it it's not like my profession.
Walks like a thatcher.
I can thatch in a pinch.
Just an emergency situation. Yeah. So it came from that. And a few projects where we might have needed to do some wattle daub, and the daub is a mix of usually a bit of clay, a fair bit of aggregate, so say sand, gravel, things like that, for example, and fibers, so quite a lot of chopped straw, or it could be hay, things like that. I realized that at some point we just didn't have the skills. We didn't have the right recipes. The daub was cracking. It's not meant to do that. And it bugs me so much to go anywhere, honestly, anywhere in Europe, but for the moment between France and the UK, this is where I live. And you have
that sounds as frustrating anyway. Sorry. Yes.
These beautiful reconstructed buildings. They say, well, it's wattle and daub, and well, you can see that there's massive cracks in the wall. So either you have a choice there. You have, well, people at the time didn't really know how to build. Of course not. They had only tens of thousands of years to learn that, but thanks very much. And the second one, which is to me the weirdest and probably descended from Victorian ideas, oh, don't worry, it was the job of women and children to repair it constantly. Because, of course, we have nothing else to do.
And they weren't being murdered, yeah.
They weren't cut up. Make houses.
Marla, I feel like there's like a... there's a passion here about daub. Is this your specialism? Is that something that you're focusing on there in particular, apart from, you know, thatch, which you can do in a pinch?
Well, so that's my second, earth building, is my second specialty. And very strangely, because I specialize in paint making, and you can't make paint and paint the walls if you don't know how to make the walls.
So that really is a, I can't paint
it. Really is.
It really is.
Yeah. So, I need to build a wall. I've got this paint. What am I going to do with it?
Oh, man. What can I do with this paint?
So
that's fascinating. I love it.
It's
and to
a
be honest,
hole.
I feel like it's a very archaeological mind as well.
Start at the surface and then you realize you have to go deeper. Then you reach foundations and you keep digging. Oh, there's so much to know. There's so many questions. It never ends. If anybody wants to start, please do start, because it never ends. But it's all good.
But did you get sort of training in it? Did you just kind of learn as you go?
It's in the UK currently really difficult to find courses and to find training. So the first thing I did was try to find, is there somebody teaching wattle and daub? And there was one site, Orchard Barn, in the southeast of England that was teaching, and I could not go there. So basically, I had to find another way. And if you look in any country in northwestern Europe, potentially the world, as far as I know, there's earth building groups. They are professionals. They are there. They do exist. They are fairly discreet, but there's many of them. And in the UK, we have Ebuki, Earth Building UK and Ireland. And they have connections all over the world. There's several in my previous village in the south of England. There are people who specialized in clay plasters, others that are specialists in earth floors. There's so much that I didn't know when I just got, out of archaeology. No. There's no crossovers, basically. That's what I'm trying to say. So it has been a big... quick turnaround in mindset, going from, well, I don't know, maybe I should go to Indonesia or Eastern Europe to find the last people who still work with earth and cob. Turns out 15 minutes away from my house, there's at least three. So if you look for them, they will be there. But quite often, they're not connected to archaeology at all. sometimes connected to heritage and historic buildings, but quite often it's still fairly modern. So sites or archaeologists might not want to talk to them too much, or they don't know they exist. And the professionals, well, I've met some that had never visited an open air museum and never considered archaeology before. Because why would you?
Because it's
amazing. Yeah. I know. So we need to be the bridge.
Yeah. And I mean, that kind of also relates, you mentioned it a little bit, I can't remember if it was earlier in this episode or in the last episode, that kind of balance between sort of archaeological authenticity and actual practical sort of restrictions of the material, of the location, but also of the modern day. Because I guess, these are people, these groups, for example, they're proficient in these traditional techniques, but they still have to work within the restraints of like modern health and safety and all of that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So how does that come into your work as well in terms of archaeoconstruction?
That really, it will depend on the site or on the client, say. It could be an individual. See, if you are in an open air museum and you want to build a reconstruction of an ancient building, no matter which one it is, you will want visitors in it. You might want to use it for concerts or storytelling or courses and events. If that's the case, you will have to make sure you install electricity or you have a version of lighting. It's very frustrating when you have made a very good, well-informed archaeological reconstruction of a building. Mm-hmm. And people go, oh, yay, but will we be able to use it at midnight, like in the winter? Like, no. No. You need to make a massive fire. You need oil lamps. You need people. So if you need light in a building to use it in a way it wasn't planned for at the time, you need to think about the modern equivalent. Hmm. There's many ways to disguise, say, electricity. And on some sites, absolutely not. You will not have any modern conveniences, say, in a historical building. On other sites, they really like it and they can't do without it. So it entirely depends. But as you mentioned, health and safety, in some places, you will have to have, say, a fire extinguisher, a fire alarm. You might have to have bolts that secure some timbers because the structural engineer in the local area will not trust that people have built with it for thousands of years, but under his watch, it's going to fall on somebody's head. Not to say that you should not trust structural engineers at all. I work with lovely ones.
Is this a wink-wink nudge situation here, Caroline?
No.
This is like, don't go near the castle. I do not
castle. But it entirely depends on what you want to do with your building, who you are. If it's in your own garden and you want to build a super Anglo-Saxon little house, for example, go ahead. I mean, ask planning permission and do a few things, but you'll be okay. Now, if you want to receive hundreds of thousands of visitors a year, you might need to adapt access and things like that.
No. Which I think we were talking about this in one of our last episodes, Ash, right? When we were talking about in reconstructions and then you see the like bright green fire exit sign, over one of the doors in this beautifully reconstructed iron house or like something like that.
One of my favorite like things I found out when I go down to Butstay Ancient Farm quite a lot for the Equinox stuff as a tradie and things like that. And one of the Roman villa is a registered tattoo parlor with the council. And I absolutely love that because, I got a tiny tattoo. I was like, I'm doing it. When else are you going to get tattooed in a reconstructed Roman villa? And the tattoo artists were all set up and everything. And then they were like, it's really cold in here. And then the guy downstairs got the flu going. He's trying to heat the room.
Oh, my God.
It's just brilliant. It's just two worlds colliding entirely. I know, it's so fun, isn't it? But what advice would you give someone, Caroline, for someone wanting to get into this specialism?
I would say you need both. You need the archaeology and you need the practical traditional skills. So don't think that by just looking at the archaeology and what has been done before and all the super awesome experiments that so many people have done across, the world, really, you will miss out on things. You will repeat mistakes or you will miss on your local specialty, your local materials, and it will influence immensely what your reconstruction should look like. So have a go. Go have a go at finding courses and classes. Contact people. That would be actually my main massive thing. Look online, talk to people, connect with people. All of what I'm doing for the moment, 4 years ago, I would maybe five. Anyways, I would never have thought about it.
10,000 years.
It feels like it. It's been, honestly, it's been a difficult journey because we don't have registered, recognized courses for earth building for the moment in the UK. But go and chat with people, and it's such a small world. They will know who to contact. They would put you in touch with their friends, and suddenly you're going to be volunteering on something, you're going to meet other people, you're going to be part of another project. And that's how it worked out for me. I volunteered quite a lot of my time for a very large project at the start, and I've been contacted back. I've been hired as a helper, then an assistant, and now I'm working with the same people. So don't let anyone tell you that, oh, that doesn't exist anymore, nobody's doing it. Check out the Heritage Craft Association and dig deeper. There will be somebody in your local area.
Archaeology. Which is basically, yeah, right, archaeology. Which, I mean, is basically what we did for this quest as well, right? We were like, well, we don't know about this, but we, you know, researched and remembered that we had you stuck in our cupboard. So luckily it's a form of networking, right? Sticking people in your cupboard.
We sure do network
along down there. Yes, don't do that. Don't recommend keeping all the experts in cupboards. No, we do need them. But I think that's pretty good. I mean, we can summarize now what we're going to do for the Fallowhide settlement. I think since we've had one settlement, at least in the Great Plains, I think we should do the woodland one. So we could do, you know, upside down basket.
Yeah, perfect. Sounds good.
And then we could also suggest that they have another one where it's like, you know, the upside down basket, but with furs and different materials for showing different settlements and moving following, you know, that kind of hunter-gatherer lifestyle that the Fallowhide seem to have. And maybe we could even put a little bit of trade in there to show, oh yeah, we did get reeds from the stores or something like that. What do you guys think? Is there anything else we could add?
Would they have Daub, or that's not really, would that be also like a temporary settlement thing? Yeah.
Oh, it can be. I mean, Daub panels are mentioned in some Roman texts as you put them up for the party and then you take them down. So,
fancy panels. Maybe they got something from the elves and they put it up and the elves are around. Like, look, we've got some nice stuff.
Because that's what you do. If you have a bit of clay around and enough, any kind of branches or even rope, natural rope, you make a structure, you put a bit of clay, a bit of sand, a lot of fibers, mix together, put your Daub, smooth it nicely. Nobody's going to know what's inside. And then you paint it. And that's another question, the pigments and the paint and the blah, blah, blah. But
that could be a whole other episode. Maybe we could just put you back in the cupboard for now.
Oh, no. I've got the shrinking smell ready.
I mean, there is some nice treats in there.
But that would be, I mean, that's definitely something that we would have to work with the local hobbits with as well, I guess, in terms of if we're looking at things like designs and stuff like that. And that would have to be something we do a sort of ethnographic collaboration with, perhaps.
Archives.
Absolutely, because we already know that they have major Fallowhide connections as well.
Yeah. So that's okay. All right. So lots of wood. We need to get the children and the elderly out there doing their thing.
Away from Caroline as possible.
I'm sorry. Keep away from Caroline and her specialist tools. And and do a couple. So a couple of different reconstructions we can offer them then. That sounds like good fun. Oh, perfect. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think then that's about it for this episode of And My Trowel. We very much hope that you enjoyed this quest. Thank you so much, Caroline, for helping us out with this particular problem. It was great to have you join us. We've definitely learnt a lot. If people want to hear more about what you're doing, where's the best place for them to find out?
For the moment, it would be my Instagram account with Pario Gallico, and I'm hoping to create a brand new account and one day a website, and that will be called Reconstruct with a K.
Oh. Well, thank you so much for joining us yet again and for putting up with being shoved in the guest cupboard.
That's no problem. Thanks for inviting me.
And thank you to all of you for listening and joining in on this quest. If you enjoy these episodes, as always, please do like, subscribe, follow us, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps to support the show. If you're interested in hearing more fun archaeology content, make sure to check out the other shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network. And if you have any future episode ideas or just want to get in touch, you can find all of our contact information as well as links and further information on what we discussed today in the show notes.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.